The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 21st of January, 2021. On the podcast today, Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, gives his view on the market and on stocks in his portfolio and also the ones he's liking, including Sage Group. We talk about Brand Shield, SourceBio International, Verici, Roslyn Data Technologies, Alico and Taylor Wimpey. We also mentioned a few others, I think. Plus, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about Iron Ridge Resources, strategic minerals, and Anglo-Asian mining. And as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked or read RNSs too. And by the way, you can see these lists on voxmarkets.co.uk. We see lots of other content. There's an article there in Vesarian. There's a video there in Salt Lake Potash with Tony Sirichik and Francesca. There's something on article on 88 Energy. And of course, there's our COVID-19 index. Check that out. There's the biggest rise there today is Gfinity, up 10% pretty much to 4.6. Biggest faller is Cromec Group, down 4% or 4.44 to 17.2. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
Welcome to this simulcast. That's what it's called. We're podcasting and videocasting. If you're watching on YouTube, don't forget, hit that subscribe button and notification bell if you're the next one to your inbox. And Paul Hill, equity analyst, full-time investor, joining me. You're right, fella.
Yeah, morning, Justin. Apologies for not making you last week. It's been a sort of really busy time on the market, as you can imagine.
Yeah. But do you know what? It's a little bit of me is worried, but I think I'm not really worried because, I mean, like you, you know, I've been investing now for, we've gone through quite a few, you know, big falls in the market, and generally it always comes out the other end better, you know. But the market's very bullish at the moment. A lot of people are bullish, and, it, you know, it's a contradictory play, isn't it? Contrarian play. That means if everyone's bullish, everyone's in, where can the market go from here? And I understand looking forward, you think, well, we can't go wrong. Surely the economy is going to open back up in a month or two's time. But it's a bit worrying when everything's rising and everyone's bullish, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you get that sort of like concept, don't you? Everybody's on the same side of the boat and therefore it capsizes.
Yeah.
Which is what was actually quite an interesting stat. There was a commentary from legendary investor Jeremy Grantham about 2 days ago. I don't know whether you saw that, but no. He was pointing out to sort of like there was instances of bubbles around, and he sort of singled out Tesla, and he said, if you take the market cap of Tesla and look at the amount of cars it produces, then on a valuation basis, each car which comes off the factory floor is worth $1.3 million each, compared to General Motors, which is a 9,000. So it just shows you sort of the difference in valuation between an EV and an actual normal sort of like OEM manufacturer. But I would actually sort of like point investors that this is not a homogeneous market. There are definitely bubbles out there that I would not be investing in. You've got to tread carefully, and you just got to point to, you know, SaaS and cloud and EV and renewables, which are particularly big hotspots. But equally, there's still a lot of stuff out there that is reasonably good value. I mean, you know, and we'll talk about that on some of my portfolio, because I know everybody's saying, oh, God, it's really high and it's nosebleed levels on the actual markets, and it is in certain areas. But I can tell you, my portfolio is still actually pretty underpinned by sound fundamentals and valuation metrics. I mean, I can see these businesses still doing well. I mean, I know I had a bad year last year, and I've talked about it, and I wasn't bothered particularly because I expected a good.
You've got to be bothered, surely. You've got to be bothered. Yeah, well, I mean, if you're looking forward,
you and I are the same ilk. I've gone through three recessions now in the factory, a big sort of down. One in the 90s, early 2000s, and then 2008, 2009. And I wouldn't call this last one a recession. So I'm used to sort of like big drawdowns. Where I get really worried the business is damaged for the long term. I'm not that bothered about price as long as the the actual base business is still going to do well. And I know we've talked about this many a time, and I ditched a couple of them and I didn't think we'd get through the COVID valley. And then I've held everything else, which has done and has actually done well. But it's taken time to come back. So it's a matter of looking at your own portfolio and looking for spots to invest in, because there still is decent value out there if you look in the right areas. But overall, yes, you've got to feel as though the market is overbought. I mean, you've just got to look at some of the metrics. In the US, the S&P 500 is currently trading at its all-time high compared to a US GDP of about 185%. It's sort of like NASDAQ is just on well over 30 times forward earnings. And, a lot of good news is already priced in. So if you're in these high octane areas that have followed momentum, particularly Robinhood trades, then you just got to expect there could well be a bit of an unwind soon.
But that unwind, surely there's contagion. I mean, like I said with Tesla, you could argue Tesla's overvalued, but it's the market leader in one of the biggest trends ever. EVs, phenomenal. Like the internet's like electricity, pretty much. It's a huge trend, but it may come back a little bit. But if there is a big sell-off in these big stocks, then surely the market, the rest of the market will feel that. But I agree with you. It's a market of stocks. And you look at, if I look at my portfolio, I could argue that anyone that's really sort of super overvalued, but you could argue it's undervalued compared to its peers, is Ilika. It is overvalued completely on current metrics. But if you compare it to QuantumScape, which is worth $20 billion, exactly the same place, in fact, it's got no revenue at all, and they're not going to start producing until 2026. In fact, it's undervalued. So it's really odd. But if you look at it, right, if you look at the vaccine, the only thing we should be looking at, really, from the economy point of view, is hospital admissions. That's the reason why we're locked down, because the NHS can't cope, and 4,000 people a day have been admitted. I looked at the stats yesterday. Did you know that 90% of those people being admitted to hospital are 65 and over. Right. 80% are 75 and over. Now, yeah. Those are people being vaccinated right now, and 4.6 million have been vaccinated. They're going to complete these vulnerable groups beyond the 65 plus by mid-February, and they're sort of nearly on target. They're just a little bit behind it. So once that pressure is taken on the NHS, the economy can open. So that's the important stat. But I still think, when everyone's bullish.
The other stat, just backing that one up, Justin, you had a go at me last year for my numbers, but I'm impressed by you sort of like keeping a track of really the salient drivers of the economy and the stock market. But to back that up is that when you do get that reopening trade, as you've just pointed out, there is sort of like the savings rate has just been phenomenal. I mean, it's been like 10% of GDP. It's been a huge amount of people's disposable income they've managed to save, and they're squirreled away for experiences. Yeah. And then the other side of the coin, which is just enormous, is the amount of money supply. In the US, it's approaching sort of like 15, 20%. In the UK, it's like 14%. If you look at M2, which is basically a gauge of how much money's sloshing around, it's phenomenal. And where's that got to go? It's got to find a home, hasn't it? Yeah. But I would say the other big gauge when it comes to these really high, long-duration assets that are valued in the sky and are predicated on returns in 10 years' time, then the thing to really watch, and I talked about this to Katie Potts at Herald earlier on, in the week and stuff, if you see an increase in bond yields, then by default, you will get a compression of valuation multiples. Because if you're being intellectually honest, you've had a huge boost to those long duration assets because bond yields have come down. Not interest rates, but bond yields have come down. But if you look at the 10-year treasury, it was 1.2, I saw the other day, from about 0.6. And it's moving on basically inflation expectations. And therefore, if inflation expectations move up, it means the bond yield has to rise just to keep the same level of real return that the bond guys get. So you get that natural seesaw type of movement on the stock market. And what that means, though, is if the economy is still doing well, but bond yields rise, long duration assets, your Teslas, your EVs, do badly. But because you've got a reopening trade, a shed load of money coming in from people like me and you have saved, who want to go down Alton Towers, etc., or go off foreign holiday or whatever, you could see exactly. You could see the stocks, the cyclical ones that depend on that, actually having a stormer. And you saw that exactly in 2000 when the dot-com bubble burst, but all the old economy stocks had an absolute flipping field day in 2000. I mean, my portfolio rocketed in 2000, not because I was in all the dot-com, but because I was in all the what people called as rubbish. Did really, really well. So I don't think this year is going to be all boats do the same thing. You will get some boats doing well, which I'm hoping my portfolio is positioned to do that if you get a reopening trade. But I actually think some of the gas in these high octane stocks that depend on long return, long duration returns, i.e. 5, 10, 15 years, they will naturally see valuation compression. They may not do badly in performance, but in valuation terms, their rating will come down.
But it's funny, we talk about sort of Tesla and all that stuff, and we talk about, and one of the big mistakes I made, and in fact, I read it in this book, in this, I know you're probably laughing, 100 Baggers book, where a guy who actually talked to people who had 100 Baggers, basically they held for years and years, of companies they believed in, and they basically, it took them about 20, the average time it took for a 100 Bagger, 26 years. That's how long you have to hold for. So basically, it's about long-term investing. And he'd spoken to many guys who'd done this, and one of the guys who stuck with me, he said, don't pay any attention too much to the macro. You can't do a lot about it. Look at the companies you hold. How are they getting affected? That's all you need to look at. If they're improving, don't worry about the share price too much. You know, if the business is doing well and it's growing some way, just focus on that. And if you've got a spare cash, if you're confident, buy some more. If the companies, and look at companies. It's a market of stocks. It's not a stock market. We always think that everything happens at the same time to every company, and it doesn't. Like I said, during the when everything was selling off, recently. Back last year now. It's amazing how fast I was. Dash for Cash was back in March last year. It's nearly a year. But, there's COVID stocks went nuts, and that was the time to get into COVID stocks. So there's always parts of the market that's hot. Yeah. There's always parts that are cool down. So you're right. I mean, that's why it's good to have a bit of, when you're looking at diversity, it's not about number of stocks you hold, is it? It's about what you hold, what sectors you hold. Because it's worth looking at that. And when I look at mine, I try to get hot trends, long-term trends. But I've also got a recovery play that I think is going to be a long-term recovery play. And so it's always good to diversify, because you don't want all your portfolio going down in the same sort of bubble burst. You want some of it going up, So it's always
And the other thing I would add, when you do get market discontinuity, it's more important than ever to look at the economy in interlocking or companies interlocking, because a lot of them have effectively get impacted by, they may be doing well, but other parts of the economy may be doing badly. Mm. And you could have something with a really strong position, but actually really suffers. You think like Google, for instance, has a big exposure to the travel industry and therefore went backwards last year, just through advertising. And you might have sort of customer weakness. Like, remember, you got the whole sort of the banking problem in 2008, simply because some of the strong banks all went down because that people were worried that the weaker ones were going to be, going to take them down as well. So you've actually got to look at a lot of interrelational sort of like situations or correlations and that kind of stuff. So it isn't just looking at the company and the industry it's in. It's also looking at maybe suppliers, maybe customers, maybe regulators. It's a whole bunch of different stuff. And that's the beauty of investing. It's a moving feast. It's a moving part, and you get brighter all the time.
I say that one of the most interesting things about investing, and I think it's a crime it's not taught in school, to be honest. I was inspired. In fact, I got a little project that helps for people start people off investing. So I was encouraged or inspired by my economics A level teacher, who started a stocks and shares competition. And I'd obviously heard of shares, but I didn't know what a portfolio was or anything like that. But I got that lit the passion in me, and from then I was always been interested in the market. It's like a living, breathing thing. And when people are furloughed, and I saw someone tweet this, a similar thing, when people are being furloughed from their jobs and they're sitting at home being bored, the market's always been open. It's a living beast, comes alive on a Monday morning, and it's moving, it's breathing, and spits things out. I love it. It's always active, and it just keeps you occupied, and you're always learning. I've learned more about companies and sectors, like from mining to pharmaceutical companies, anything but revenue, all through reading RNSs and just doing some research. And you can learn everything about anything pretty much in the market, because that's the way business works. But let me ask you a question then, okay? Yeah, let me ask you a question here.
Also, Justin?
Sorry, I froze me. Let me ask you a question. If we think we've rallied strongly and we think we do a pullback, do you take precaution to that? Do you be preemptive? Do you try to trim a little, or just sit and wait and see what happens?
I typically use time as my hedge. So I'm happy, as long as the business's their intrinsic worth is underpinned, then I'm happy to take short-term volatility. So I don't tend to buy sort of derivatives or put options, because they tend to be expensive at the time. Mm. So I don't do that. What about you? Do you do
no,
it?
No, no, no. I mean, this time round, I'm sure there's going to be some kind of correction or sell-off. There's one every year anyway, a correction pretty much. But I was very bearish before the crash, and for a long time, and I was like 60% in cash anyway. And I said, something's going to go wrong. I didn't see there was warning figures, you know, red flags being flashed everywhere before, oddly, and then COVID came out, and that really tipped the market over. But I was starting to get worried and bearish then, you know. So, but now I'm less so. I understand there's going to be a correction probably, but I'm less so, and I'm not. I don't want to go into cash because I think the things I'm holding, I'm quite happy with. But let's talk about individual stocks. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at actually just my sort of like portfolio, etc., I've still got a reasonable size of chunk of cash, largely because things like, you know, ClearStar was bought out last year, a bit of a song, but it was bought out, so I've still got some sort of cash. And my area, my stocks are relatively defensive. So if I look at my total portfolio, I mean, I know you don't, but I do, because I look at my property. My property is worth about 8% of my portfolio. I've got UK equity at 44. I've got overseas equity about 25. And then I've got 22% in cash. So I will redeploy. I'll tell you, the sector I want more exposure to, and I know I've been talking about this, is healthcare. I'd love to pick up some lovely, you know, good healthcare businesses. And there's a couple I'll talk about later on as sort of updates. So that's an area. I've got quite a bit of tech now. I mean, I know, again, I'll give you an update on some of the shares and stuff. But just on that one, Justin, I noticed you've been spending a bit of money this last week on BrandShield, which is something I know a bit about. Not about the company, because I used to invest in OpStex Security. It was actually a competitor in this cybercrime brand, you know, counterfeiting. I was just wondering, you know, in terms of USPs against its rivals, it seems to have just won a big contract, Bristol Myers or something like that.
Yeah, well, they've also, I had the guys on, they were part of Two Shields Investments. There's a company called Two Shields Investments, one of their investments there. And I had Yoav on twice on the podcast. And he just happened to mention, you know, a couple of his clients from Microsoft and Visa. I thought, what? Really? Mm-hmm. And I thought, if you're a small cybersecurity company and one of your clients is Microsoft, that says a lot, doesn't it? You think, they're in the business of software, Microsoft. They've got a lot of clever guys working there, you know? Yeah. And so this was basically spun out, BrandShield, from a domain hosting sort of service in Israel. And they're the biggest, the CEO and CTO there, is now the biggest domain sort of service site, or domain registering site in Israel. And they had a lot of companies asking them about security and cybersecurity, so they basically looked into it, did some more research, and they started offering different parts of cybersecurity, and it got better and better. And so they said, right, in fact, we should sort of, you know, almost park or put this thing to one side, the domain thing, and let it keep going, but let someone else run it, and we'll go on the cybersecurity because it's growing. And this has speeded up recently. And if you saw the reports from working from home, the amount of companies, in fact, I posted one today saying that over 70% of financial services companies have been hacked pretty much in the last year. 54% of them think it'll get worse because more people are working from home. And in fact, I was on the phone to Barclays yesterday, and I was passing around like three people. They're all working from home, you know, so there's more breaches. And I can't see it getting any. And I said, the one USB they have, I suppose, the clients is one, I suppose, because that validates them to a certain extent. Like I said, Bristol Squires, and they've done Visa, Microsoft, Levi as well. And I don't know if you saw one of their, on their Twitter feed, but they said in April last year, they worked, working with Levi as a client, they took down 429 fake sites. Levi sites in 1 month. Wow, you see the size of it. When you read spawned in 29. Yeah. So it's basically they're a service where they detect them, and they say apparently the demos they do, they go into a client, this is pre-COVID, and they say, okay, let's look. And difference is apparently other companies track general sort of abuse around the thing, but they can specifically track and and look at brand logos, all that being used. And they'll just set up their software, and it's cloud-based, so you don't have to plug anything in. It's outside the firewall, so it's not like with an internal security guard, they don't have to plug it into all their systems. And it's outside the firewall. It's cloud-based, so it's software as a service. So, and they're just basically let's say they're going to a company like Microsoft. Let's have a look at who's counterfeiting your logo or brand in the world. They basically hit the company, they'll search the internet, and within literally minutes, they've got hits and results. And so there are other services, right, we discovered those for you. We can either take them down by approaching them with our lawyers, or you can do it yourself, depends on the company. So they offer that as well. But I just think the fact that they've, and if they're really from a low base, but their revenue's pretty much doubling every year. And I think it's obviously, that's, as yet, they're still valued at $35 million, but they're only turning over about
I think ARR is about $2.5 million.
I like the growth. One thing I didn't know about USB, there are some other people out there acting like this, doing the same kind of thing. Of course, there's lots out there. But I was thinking, when you're getting big clients, that's a big difference. That's a point of difference there, you know, like that.
One thing, I mean, remember, I invested in Obstec Security, okay? So I know a reasonable about the industry. And the biggest bugbear this whole industry was that none of your customers paid for it. So if you look at Levi's, you look at Microsoft, you look at Visa and MasterCard and all these kind of guys, given they've got a very small turnover, how many of their clients are really paying more than peanuts for this service? Because is it given away? I think it's given away for free in a lot of sort of other areas. Yeah. And so it's not priced in the value that it generates, because lots of other people are basically giving it away for free or something near enough. So unless it's got a really step change in technology that's going to fundamentally change the industry, you're never going to be able to price it how it should be. If you just think about it, Levi's is massive. It's a huge counterfeiting problem. They should be able to get $5 million a year from Levi's. Mm. And you look at the sales alone and it's peanuts. So I would say, Is it the technology now catching up and it's a step change, hence they're really going to drive the top line? Or actually, is it basically, they're selling to more clients and they're growing, great, but they're never going to make shed loads of money simply because nobody pays for this product?
I've seen that they've gone from smaller clients up to bigger ones, and it's quite encouraging that. But we'll see. I mean, it's the first half of revenue of 2020 was almost equivalent to that to 2019.
It's still small.
It is still small. Of course.
I mean, Microsoft would just be enormous, wouldn't it? I mean, you think how many people sort of knock off Windows and Office? It's all over the world.
No. So it's very much as I want to see if that sales can continue for how long it continues. But let's be honest. And if you do a search on the internet, there's plenty of companies doing that. But I'm just hoping they have something different. At the moment, there's a little bit of hope because they've signed up some of these big names. And I'll see.
Just typically, how much do you put into one of your stocks? I mean, not this one. But
at the moment, I will go what about 10% of total portfolio values?
That's like a six-figure number, is it? You put a low six-figure in there.
I'm not telling you what my value is. Because, do you know what? It's no point telling you the value because there are all people listening.
You asked me. You've asked me many a time.
But you've never told me.
I have.
What?
I've said about the value of your house.
Yeah, well, my house is worth £3,000.
Yeah. Okay, how many multiples for your?
I'm not going to even tell you the value of my house because I will do first of all, when I first scale in, it'd probably be 5%, and then if I really like what's happening and it develops there, then I'll probably go up to 10, 15, and I can go up to 25 if I really like it. I think it's really undervalued and no one's catching on. The story's come out, it's evolving, and I'm thinking, hang on a sec, there's no one buying this and the share price hasn't moved anywhere, then I maybe go. But sometimes you see something, you think, it's a bit of a no-brainer, and you should never say that because you think I've overlooked something.
Now, nothing's a no-brainer.
No, Brand Shield, at the moment, is not particularly cheap, but there's companies when I first started scaling into Escape Hunt, for example, and that was valued at $6 million, and they had $4 million in cash. And I thought, hang on a sec, this is a bit silly. And I thought, there's no way people... I mean, of course, they took a massive knock because of the lockdown and they just jumped down, and people said, well, we don't know how long we're going to lock down for. But then they've got the digital side now, the played home side, which is pretty much covering cash burn, and they got furloughed everything, not burning anything. So, and yet they're still expanding. They've got, I think, about 40 more sites now than they did when they start lockdown in March. And again, how long is lockdown going to last for? Another month, maybe? And then we'll start unlocking. Most of the people who are filling the beds in NHS will be vaccinated. So it'll be fine. Then the recovery will be on. But then it's too late then. I said, if you go back and look at the 2E chart, vaccination day on the 9th of November, it shot up broke the 200-day moving average. It broke a downtrend on that day. It's come back a little bit and it'll go back up. But that was a day. There was one vaccination. There was no sort of planned rollout then. That was just the announcement of Pfizer getting, a vaccine out there. So, you've got to be, the market does look 6-12 months ahead. So when people are saying, oh, but we're still in lockdown. Yeah, but think, 6 months down the line, where are we going to be then? And I think a longer-term view helps. Sometimes you've got to, a bit of guts and balls to hold on when there's tough times. Yeah. But you've got to look further down the line. Is this company going to improve in 6 months, 3 years, 5 years? Yes. So buy it, get it cheap now, and that's it.
We have to take a gamble. That's the kind of thing, isn't there? The breakthroughs on the vaccines were just fabulous, much better than anybody thought. The efficacy rates were just absolutely monumental, and the vaccines came forward so much quicker than anybody anticipated. I mean, I still think you've had basically if you turn the clock back last year, you had sort of like three really tail risk events. The first one was the pandemic. You don't get that once every 100 years. The second one was the Federal Reserve and central bankers just absolutely churning masses and masses of money out and just underpinning the whole world, which has never happened more other than in a war, which was 1944-45, or even the First World War when they did that, something equivalent. And then the third one was basically the breakthrough on the medical side was just faster and better than anybody possibly imagined. So you had sort of like, three black swans in succession, all in 1 year.
I think we're bound to have fallout, though. We're going to have fallout. I mean, like I said, I think we're going to have a big sell-off at one point during this year when we get sort of back to semi-normal, but you realise, in fact, we're now back at where we were in 2018, pretty much, as far as the economy is concerned. We've got another 2 years to make it up, so I think we'll have that. I think that it's like, if you look at 1930, you had some tremendous rallies in the 1930s and tremendous sell-offs as well. So it's like a trader's market, really. But
I would say, Justin, I don't think you're right. I actually think you're going to get sell-off in the high-octane stuff as bond yields increase. And then I think that the old economy stuff is going to, and the cyclical stuff is going to have a rip roar in the next 2 or 3
Hopefully,
years because that pent-up demand savings rate, money's still going to be coming in.
Yeah, and do you know what? You're right. The central banks are also, they are reacting more positively and they're quick to react. Whereas back at the very, one of the things in the 30s was they didn't. That was the problem. That compounded the issue. Yeah. And then the only thing that got them back on their feet was they went to war and started gearing up the economy for war. And so that, in the end, that was brought them out of that sort of almost 10, 15 years of recessions they had. I think it'll be not as volatile as that, but I think we'll have a bit of a correction, which we do every year anyway.
And I think it'll be sector specific. That's the point. It's going to be basically, I think growth will, I think, we'll wait and see. I mean, who knows? I mean, it just is my view.
Go through your companies.
This morning, I mean, one of the companies I've invested in was Sage, basically the accounting HR company, came out with a good first quarter.
Perfect for you, that is. Perfect for you.
I know, yeah, exactly. I said it was like, it's a safe, Eddie, steady. It's undervalued compared to...
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that a lot of accountants hold stocks, shares in Sage because they like to look at the accounts of Sage?
No, I don't. Because they don't put their own money into stocks and shares. You've got to be an investor.
That's nuts, Eddie. That's crazy, isn't it? It's nuts when you think about it.
Some people are just too prudent. They basically don't
I suppose accountants are.
You've got to basically be prepared not to sleep well at night on a few times in the year. But anyway, so I bought Sage, perfect. And they put out a positive trading update. In fact, they had their sales increased in the first quarter, which was a good performance because their comparatives this time last year in the back end of 2019 were actually stellar. So to increase on something really good was actually done. And that's when the shares are up 4 or 5% today. They paid a dividend already in January, so I'm very happy. As I said when I briefed people on why I bought it, that because the reason I was always sort of very skeptical of the management team But it absolutely broke its mold 6 months ago when it said, we've got to grow. We can't just stay where we are. We're going to invest in new products. We're going to invest in sales and marketing and push the top line up. And my view is if they can achieve that, and I actually know the chief marketing officer personally, she's excellent from O2. I mean, she's top draw. If she and the CTO can get, you know, basically that ship moving in the right direction, then I'm telling you, this business is going to be valued at 4, 5, 6, maybe even 7 times sales. It's currently less than 3.5 times sales, even at £6. And yeah, with a dividend, 3% yield, I'm happy to wait. So I think this has got a low downside because it's priced to not grow. And if the management team actually do move that top line up, the dial up, then they're going to do really well. And the reason why, it isn't just going to be a self-help sort of stuff. There is a huge catch-up trade in small, medium companies to digitize and cloudify because they're a long way behind all their large cap peers. And you'll see that. And they haven't yet moved their main line back office systems. They've done Zoom and they've done, you know, Teams and this sort of stuff, but they haven't done their sort of like, you know, their main system. And that's all coming. So, you know, cloudifying, digitizing the small, medium-sized companies, which is their bread and butter stuff, are they going to do really well? And actually, you know, they're also put a new, big, larger product together called Intact, which is actually selling, it's all BI, AI, and, you know, sort of automation. That's actually selling really well in the States.
What's
also,
BI? So
roll out. Yeah, you know, business intelligence.
Oh, okay. Well,
sorry about this.
Do you know what? I think that's mitigated because everyone's using AI. I was, sooner or later, someone's going to have to come up with a new one that's not so generically used as that. So I thought BI is the next
business
one.
Business intelligence. Yeah. So
as long as they don't use BS, it's fine.
It is, yeah. So there's lots of potential tailwinds there. So I'm really quite, you know.
That was a sage investment then, Paul, eh?
I was a sage investment.
So you have the trade. You've had some traits of an accountant, but like you say, some accountants are too risk averse. So maybe you're a maverick accountant because you take the like the risk. You're like a rock star accountant.
I think I'm just a sad accountant. But on the same theme, in accounting, sort of cloud, SaaS, 90% of Sage, by the way, is recurring revenue streams. You had Rosslyn last week. Basically, and these guys who we talked about before they help companies save money, make themselves more efficient, etc. And also have got that really, really good...
Broke out on the chart there. It's broken out. 6.5 was the level sort of it kept trying to beat. And it's beaten that now up 7.75. Cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you come down to management teams, etc. And it looks as though what this company really did need was Superman. And they brought him in like 6 months ago. And that was basically, you know, they call him the chief customer officer, but it really is the sales director, I think, for everybody's understanding. A guy called Paul Watts. And it's not the guy from, who was that? Who was that band who did Jam? The Jam did Paul Watts. Oh, that was Davey Watts, wasn't it? Paul Watts. But anyway, they brought this guy
Paul
in.
Paul Weller, you talking about? Ian Paul Watts.
Yeah, well, Paul Weller, but they did Davey Watts, didn't they? But anyway. That's besides the point. But
I don't think the share price would have risen if they'd hired Paul Weller or someone to watch from Paul Weller.
Yeah, you're probably right. But the thing is, in the 6 months he's been there, the pipeline's increased by 18%. It's gone above the qualified pipeline. And what's happened is that, you've had these lockdowns, which has put a sort of break on the conversion of that pipeline, but it's all late stage. And nothing's been lost. No orders have been lost. I could just see again, with these companies, they'll just, once we get through, once people are vaccinated, and you'd said, right, you know, by Easter, in terms of, you know, the most vulnerable, these companies are going to put their POs, they're going to start signing them off. Yeah. And with 18% increase in your pipeline and, you know, 80, 90% recurring revenue streams, you don't need that much to convert on the top line to make a real difference. And again, this is like exactly the same story as Sage. If they can get that top line moving, you're going to see a huge sort of like re-rating in the shares. And I interviewed the guys last week and they were the most undervalued big data AI business in the world by a mile, given where their growth can be. And they still are very, very cheap simply because they'll get a huge re-rating if they can move this the top line in double digits. And I believe they will do so. So I'm actually delighted to hold them. And as I say, the Superman, he's got a lot of sort of responsibility on his shoulders, but he's doing a good job so far. Yeah, and I remember I chatted to the CEO, the CFO, and I said to him, just give the guy some more money, you know. If what he's done with the first lot, if he can do the same again, Because all you need then is, once corporates get confident, and they say the same thing will happen, you'll have that huge pent-up demand. Those orders that haven't actually been lost hopefully will be signed. You'll convert it, you'll add to the IRR, so the ARR, which is already the recurring revenue streams, and Bob's your uncle. You're going to get a big increase in your in the top line and your re-rating.
Exactly
the same. I mean, just on that software theme, sort of like cloudifying, and is Alico came out with a very nice trading update on Monday, I think it was, and they had flat revenues, which was a terrific result for this build tech software company. But their profits went up by 10% because they've obviously internally they haven't been spending on trade shows and all this sort of stuff. But their cash just absolutely rocketed by about 5 million, from 1 million to over 6 million. And you look at that, and it's just like a money machine. It's done absolutely brilliantly. So the management team are really ticking the boxes. And again, the same thing is if they can get that top line moving, which I believe they can, and I own, say, Alico, I've owned it for years. I've owned Rosslyn, I bought it last year, as I said. I've owned Sage for 6 months now. And they're all the same thing. Terrific software, great. The whole industry they're serving is digitizing, it's cloudifying. They give great value for money in terms of saving. They've got good customer relationships. And if they can get that last piece of the jigsaw, the top line, Bob's your uncle, you're going to see a big re-rating in all three of those. And even if there is another lockdown or a hiccup, they've got all three of those companies. They've got masses of cash. They can carry on investing in their R&D, their software, their sales and marketing. Who cares? The intrinsic worth of these businesses isn't going to change, even if the share price changes. So I'm happy. I'm going to hold this one for the long term. Likewise with Alico, must have held it for 4 or 5 years, And I'll do the same with Sage because, you talked about 26 years. And you can see it with these type of businesses in terms that, you're going to get some rocky periods and there'll be a few drop balls, but direction of travel is up.
So when did you buy Alico? You've had that for quite a few years, did you?
I think I started probably 2014, 15. Probably had it for 5 or 6 years, I guess. I've never sold a single share.
That's nice, because they were down at like 20 pence back then.
And now I probably had a blended price of about 25 or something. It was quite illiquid at the time.
But that's the way to, I see people, when you start out, I said recently on a podcast, when I started out, I had very little money. I had to sort of overexpose in stocks. There's no point having, if you got a portfolio less than 10 grand you start off with, there's no point having 20 stocks, because you can't make any headway. You've got to sort of really narrow it down to almost like 2-3 stocks. And conversely, ironically, when you're starting out, you have to take on the most risk if you want to make a bit of money. And then as you build a bit of cash, you can then, diversify the risk a little bit. So when you started then, I don't ask figures, but did you start with a big chunk or did you have some...
The problem I have is because I put in large chunks, liquidity in small caps is pretty tough for me. Yeah. So if I put a big number into a large cap, I can sink it in a day. That's easy. I can get my whole position, which is what I tend to do. Mm. But in small caps, and I like the firm, sometimes I've got to drip it in. I mean, just for instance, with Alico, then it was dripping it in. I just couldn't put enough money into it, basically, for a long period. So I just kept on buying without on any weakness. But Rosslyn, I was lucky because there was a institution on the other side of the trade who wanted to get out. So I rang up, I've got Kestrel Partners who wanted to get out. I just said to Oliver Scott, I've just put a buy order on at 5p for X, million shares. If you want it, hit it. And he hit it. So there you go. I got it all in one shot, which is unusual.
So when you started off, I started off and I had what? I was probably low sort of. I started off with a low five-figure amount, and then. What did you start off? Did you start off with a nice chunk, or was it?
No. I started the same. I started the same amount, as you did. My investment career started in the early 90s. Okay.
Yeah.
And I the reason why was because then I started to work and I saved a few bob. Yeah, and then I started investing. And I typically put it into companies like Unilever. I put it into big caps because I was working hard, etc. But it was by the end of sort of like, I'll tell you what it was. It was basically 10, 12 years later. I'd done so well on my stocks and shares over that long period. And I got the right side of the trade of the dot-com because I was in the old economy stocks. Then, you know, I got to the stage where I had a reasonable good six-figure number to start investing in, you know, in companies when I just started to do it professionally. Yeah. So it's taken 30 years of sort of like, you know, shuffling coppers around with the first 10 to then putting a bigger chunk in. And now typically I wouldn't put anything less than a reasonable figure in. I just isn't worth it for me.
You buffered then. What did you say? A reasonable 8-figure in, you said, did you?
No.
You buffered, but he's come up with that.
Swimming in money. There's no doubt about it. I'm not swimming in money.
But do you know, the more I look at stocks and shares and the more I mean, generally, you destroy value, I think, most people in stocks and shares by trading too much and jumping in and out, and then you jump in the wrong one, jumping out. And trading can actually destroy your wealth rather than build it. And I think getting a decent company and hold it for a longer term is you're more likely to build decent wealth that way than actually just trading non-stop, jumping in and out. And I see it often, people are literally trading for 10% here, 10% there. I think, why do you want 10%, 20%? Okay, if you know, because don't you want multiples of your initial investment? And you need to have a bit. If you're lucky, it may happen that may happen in one stock, you know, in a year. But generally, that can happen over several years if you're patient and it's a good company, you know. And so, I think, you know, if anything, you know, overtrading destroys wealth, and undertrading generally does a lot better, you know.
Yeah, you've just got to be careful though, because if you do have a really good sort of like, you know, share that moonshot, then you've got to make sure you. That's that company's not overly, you're not overly.
No, exactly. Sustainable. Business. No, I often talk about pop and drop stocks, and I say where I've evolved a little bit is when I first started off, I used to invest in resource companies because they'd pop and drop on news. And basically, pop, I could double the money, sell a chunk of it, then go to the next one. And so when I started off, I had to do that to make a bit of decent money. But now I'm looking at sustainable rises. So I don't particularly want them to go nuts in a week or 2 weeks or whatever. But but I want a decent return over a year, 2-3 years. But so there's a difference. I mean, like I said, when you first start, I think I was literally in the dot-com boom. I started and you literally double overnight. But conversely, I look back and I lost over that period there when actually it all popped. I was making good money then every week, just trading nonsense. You know, the companies would announce they'd change the name to a .com and it would double. And you think, wow. Yeah, yeah. And so I get my, but I lost money over that period. And I thought, okay, where'd I go wrong there? And I realised it's just trading essentially. And and now I've gone towards, you know, yeah, exactly. So anyway, any other stocks?
I mean, remiss not to actually mention there's two on the healthcare stuff that I'm really sort of looking over. Source Bio put a trading update at the start of. I spoke to Jay, the exec chairman there, and I mean they just had eye popping 2020 numbers. I mean you just look at the sales increased by 140%, and the EBITDA was up 370%. So, you know, and that blistering pace of growth is not going to abate at all. It's going to carry on in this year. And the other thing, which is, and it's largely driven, these guys do COVID testing, they do medical diagnostics, sort of like screening and genomics and all this sort of stuff. So the real driver this last year or the last 6 months has been their PCR COVID testing, antigen testing. And frankly, you know, that's carrying on. They've got a surge agreement with the NHS at the start of the year, which will give them, you know, and inject even more growth. The problem is it's keeping up with demand. It's just absolutely gone through the roof.
Yeah.
And they've got this big contract with the NHS that hopefully will be signed in February. But given they've just signed one, a surge agreement with the same customer, I think there's a good chance they're actually going to do it. And they're adding on to the mobile. So this year is just massively underpinned by, you know, the growth underpinned by testing. But equally, their base business is really well placed for a reopening trade because you've got healthcare diagnostics, which basically, you know, you have that horrible, horrible stat which came out from the NHS, I think it was last week, with 4.5 million people on waiting lists for things like, you know, cancer screening, for biopsies and all this sort of stuff. The highest ever it's been, when, you know, ever reported. So 4.5 million people.
Yeah, I saw that. The thing that stuck in my head was like there was this time last year before COVID, it was like 4,000 people, something like that, on and now it's like 200,000 people. And I thought, that is a huge increase in a year, and so that was really scary. I know, and you realise, you know, that, yeah, do you know what? I was talking about the update they did, SourcePilot, with the guys from Vox in the morning call. I said, that is an amazing update. If you look at their valuation compared to some of the other COVID stocks, who are pure play COVID testing stocks, they're on par valuation-wise. And this company has a sustainable rise here and got a business that's not just COVID testing. And
Well, I mean, say you'll see this huge amount of, this bow of, or this, this mountain of patients that need to be treated after we get out of lockdown, and so they're able position to be there. The genomics, I mean, what you've also had is that one thing that COVID has taught us, the pandemic, is that we need medical science genomic sequencing is a real big part of that. Personalized medicine, so that plays perfectly to what they want to do. And the other thing, what I also did was I actually look at the broker notes, because they've got a really good sort of like report which came out from Liberum. But what they did was put in some really prudent assumptions that they wouldn't sell any more COVID tests after 2022, mid 2022. And frankly, we're still going to need, we've talked about this before, but with new strains, which are ultra, contagious, and the ones where they mutate and change the protein spike, or even don't even use protein spike, we are still going to need antigen and probably also antibody testing to use as an alarm system for the world to say when there's actually another really dangerous bug out there, we need to tweak the vaccines and to effectively stop any, local outbreak in its tracks. Yeah. So we're going to still need a lot of testing going forward. And if you just assume that we are going to need testing, but we don't know how much it is, then if you run the numbers, for every 30 million of extra, revenue they do in the COVID testing, and they did more than that last year, and that was just in 6 months, but every 30 million, you get an extra quid on the valuation of the company. Yeah. And if you do an assumption that only half after mid-2022, of what they're going to do this year, which Liberum say they're going to do this year, is done from 2023 onwards on a continuous basis. Use a 10 times EBITDA multiple, and you get a share price of £4.50 versus about, I don't know, £2.10, £2.20 at the moment. Yeah. So you can really see how, and let's be clear about it, there's a super smart investor who's got the biggest share, 29%, Chris Mills from, Harwood Capital. He's been buying, he's been adding to his position because he sees the upside. These, in my view, SourceBio are priced to a downside at the moment at £2.20 or whatever it is. But actually, there's a big opportunity. So your risk-reward ratio profile for investors is up, because I just don't believe we're not going to need some sort of, pandemic testing going forward after mid-2022.
No, we will. But you know what? It's the companies that have the contracts that will get the money. And like I said, as yet, there's still companies out there being talked about on social media that don't have any contracts. I think it's a bit late. They're going to miss that.
Yeah. Another one which is well worth looking at is Verici on the healthcare side. Now, I know we've talked about this one before. Basically, they do testing for kidney transplants. Mm. But they're in development. They're doing a validation test, and they've got a huge runway ahead. The shares were listed at 20p, which was massively cheap, undervalued. They then went to about 35, 40p in the first day, and they're roughly about 90 now, I think, 80 or 90p. So if you're an investor in this company, and there's lots of them who have owned, because it's a spin out from Renalytics, if you are an investor, and you're thinking, crikey, what's actually driven that? Well, actually, I'll tell you what it is. It's just a repricing. It's investors waking up to this whole thing of using the immune system for much better and earlier, diagnosis for patients. Mm-hmm. And the biggest giant in the industry for this type of thing is CareDx. And in the same period, its shares have doubled.
Yeah.
So it's not dissimilar to what the industry giant. People are starting to realize the potential of these new medical sciences, your mRNA technology for Pfizer and for Moderna. I mean, they actually use, their sequencing is based on the same technology, so it gives you confidence that their test is going to work. Yeah. And so it's a sector re-rating is why the shares have moved up, albeit they have actually also fundamentally added a third test to they had a pre-transplant, kidney transplant test. They've got a post-operative kidney transplant test in development, and now they've added have licensed in a third from Mount Sinai out in New York, which does, once they're actually doing the surgery, to see the success of the actual transplant, how successful that's likely to be when the surgeon's actually doing it. So they've got that full end-to-end you know, diagnosis now. So, you know, I'd say the roadway for this thing is pretty big. I mean, if you assume they only win 10% of the market, which is pretty modest, Chris Mills reckons.
Why didn't you buy them though? You said you want a med tech company and you're bullish on Source Bio and very cheap, but why didn't you get into them at early stage there?
Hey, I'm just surveying the scene. There's no reason why I won't get into it, Justin. I
okay,
promise
but
you.
That, okay, but you were in there. You missed the. I always quite like getting in on that fast.
Look, mate, I'm not impatient. I talk decades. I don't talk flipping nanoseconds.
I know, but it's nice to have that initial fast rise when people actually realize. Because you research, right, more than most people, 99% of the market out there, probably. And so you know the story early on. You chatted them early on. And you think, well, hang on. People in the market are not seeing this. I can see this. So wouldn't you have jumped in both of them, a Source Bio and Virtue? If you jumped in there, you're done well. You're talking like a man who owns a stock, but you don't think it.
There's lots of stocks I love and don't jump in and get
I know,
it wrong,
I know that.
Okay?
And, you know, I know. And also, that's a part of, I've been talking about that a lot with people, like I said, over diversification. You've got to, you know, be sure on the stock you take because, you know, you don't want too many stocks. We don't start diluting your return because you can have too many, can't you? You know, it's lots of opportunity there. Yeah. You've got to pick one that's right for you, I suppose. Yeah. You know?
But I'll just give you an indication on value, yeah? I mean, they're at 90p, right? And if you assume they win 10% of the market and you use you use a 10 times sales multiple for three years, which was what the market was on, then you'd get to £3.70. But if you use what the Care DX is currently on, which is 20 times, you can see how actually it's just a re-rating of the shares. This is a great opportunity in terms of, you know, long-term value. So if I was an owner of Verici at the moment, I'd say, well, actually, it's just moving up more towards fundamentals. This is not a high octane stock. It's just really sort of like, you know, moving up with the rest of the industry. Mm. And the final one, which is, again, I know a lot of investors are into sort of the house builders and stuff. You know, I own, you know, I've got a share in, 14,000 small properties which are being built by Taylor Wimpey. Mm. And they came out with a very nice trading update last week with a record, order book and lots of cash. They're going to start repaying the dividend, underpins, you know, and they're only trading at 1.4 times book, which frankly is of this year, which is still pretty damn cheap. Mm-hmm. And I would say something which I haven't heard people talk about in the house building sector, yeah, is just think what will the pandemic, when we get to the other side, what will it mean by commercial real estate? So will we need as many offices? No. Will we need as many high streets? No. Will we need as many, you know, basically other areas that we used to always aggregate on, you know? And so what will happen is that a lot of that land will have to be repurposed.
Yeah.
Two things. One,
luxury flats.
A large chunk is going to go to residential housing, okay, and obviously sheds, i.e. online sheds, which is, you know, booming at the moment. But the other beautiful thing is if you're a house builder with plenty of cash, which is Taylor Wimpey, because it raised some money and has got, you know, I don't know, got 750 million, I think it is at the moment on its balance sheet. And you've got a lot of these people, a lot of these, you know, office owners and other, you know, this land is being sold at distressed levels. You've almost got a generational opportunity here to pick up a lot of distressed sellers as they get out of commercial property if you're a house builder. So you could see an uplift in returns because actually land in these areas, brownfield, starts getting a lot cheaper as you get distressed, you know, sellers onto the market. So I'm really positive on the house.
I don't see, especially when you have sell-offs and crash like we've had. That's an opportunity. But the housing market in the UK is always going to be buoyant. I mean, it's been buoyant for, you know, decades. It's going to people who say it's not are thinking short-term catalysts. Maybe the first loan to buy scheme, all that stuff, and first-time buyer schemes, and stamp duty. Okay, that's short-term. You may have a little blip, but if you look at, you know, house prices over the last, I don't know how many years, thousands of years, well, hundreds of years, they've gone up.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's one of the biggest bull markets ever in the UK housing market. So I just think if you get in the right price, just sit and hold. That's it, you know?
Yeah. And the other thing, when you talked about sort of like a sell-off, et cetera, also if you're, you know, an investor, think about how your portfolio is structured in terms of large cap, small cap. Mm. Because if you do need liquidity, you can always get out of a large cap.
Yeah.
You can't always get out of small caps if you want to make a move out of it. So It all depends on your risk tolerance and your time horizons, yeah, etc.
That's why with small caps, when you if you want to put a decent chunk of money in and you realise, you know, liquidity is an issue, you've got to be sure about it. You know, you can't jump in then jump out the next day because you can't get out. So you've got to say, where is this going to be in 3 years' time? You know, 3 years' time, 3 to 5 years' time. Yeah. That's where you're going to be and take the.
You get a couple of black swans though, and that bowls your flipping business case out. But I'm just giving you an indication, out of my stock portfolio, I've got 4 small caps and 4 large caps, and that gives me a bit more blend. But I've got more money in the small caps than I have in the large caps.
I start off with, like everyone did, with big caps, but I just find them a bit dry and a bit. I quite like just.
You think they're boring, don't you?
Essentially, I do.
You think bond yields are boring?
They are boring. I mean, literally, I started paying more attention to bond yields, right? More attention to bond yields in the last, say, 3-4 years than I ever have. And if anything, it's hindered my performance, I think. It's just because I start worrying about things I don't need to worry about. I think, do you know what? Yeah, how will that affect a small esports digital company in the UK? It won't, you know, or something like a med tech company. It won't to a certain extent. So, so I can get to, it's almost like saying, you know, you've only got a limited amount of attention or time span. So focus on the things that matter and leave the things you can't do. It's that quote, isn't it? You know, have the wisdom to know what you can change and not change and all that stuff. But there's certain things you can't mess with or deal with or change. And that's the macro environment to a certain extent. So just look at your stocks and see how they'll be buffeted.
I would say, if I was going to say one thing, and Katie Potts and I agreed on this.
Don't talk about bond yields and Liz Brad.
No. She is a super, super successful and smart tech investor, okay? So if there's anybody in the world who knows about technology and software, it's Katie, okay? And we both agreed that the biggest risk to technology is not that it's not going to be in demand. It flipping is. It's going to carry on, no doubt about it. It's multiple compression. If you see bond yields rising, and let's be clear about it, they're going to, because inflation expectations, we need more inflation to get away from all this debt pile we have, then bond yields are going to rise. And on the basis of bond yields, you're going to see valuation compression. So you've got to be careful which spots you're in that growth area, okay? The bond yields rising and inflation rising is good for the stock market, but bad for long duration assets in the stock market. It's bad for fixed income, and it's bad for EVs and renewables, okay, for valuations.
Okay, well, what I'll do is you just mentioned, tell us when the bond yields are, you know, when they're changing significantly.
No! Okay.
And I'll let you keep an eye on that. You just ask. Okay, cool. Marvellous. Thanks for that, Paul. And speak to you next week, hopefully, if you're not too busy. And a reminder, if you're watching on YouTube, you can subscribe to this. Hit that subscribe button, notification bell. And we'll speak next week. Cheers, fella.
Yeah, take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You all right, John?
Yes, I'm good. Thank you.
Everything's rising, isn't it? Pretty much resources, are they? Everything, are they?
I haven't seen the sector as popular as this for many, many years. There's a lot of new interest in the space. I mean, driven by a number of factors. Stimulus money and stimulus projects starting to happen, particularly in China, and of course the $1.9 trillion being pledged by the Joe Biden administration. Some dollar weakness, which always helps metals go higher. And of course, the huge change in global manufacturing towards electric vehicles and everything else that needs to go to support those electric vehicles, the wind farms for the green electricity to power, to drive those electric vehicles, the solar panels and everything else to cable everything up.
Yeah. I keep saying it over again, but I just think many people who've just started investing will not see a trend like this ever in their lives. I mean, there was a trend back in the 90s, .com, where people realised the internet was going to be very significant, but there was a lot of pop and drop there, a bubble formed. It's very similar with this, I think. You know, we're talking about things that are major trends. You know, I go back as far as electricity, the original, you know, internal combustion engine, these kind of revolutionary changes. And now we're seeing EV, you know, most governments in the world are switching to EV. And so, of course, everything in this area, in this sector, is going to rise, isn't it? We're starting to see. And I think this could, you know, when people get worried about bubbles or arises, and thing is, I think it can go on for a lot longer than we realise, you know, these sustained rises, because of course we need it. I mean, well, I just saw a report out, EV sales are growing very quickly, but they're still, you know, under 5% of the entire market. So if you understand that, there's 95% to go yet. We haven't started, have we, really?
No, you're right, we haven't started. There's 174 mega factories. Okay, they're not all gigafactories, but 174 of these factories, they are all increasing their production of batteries for electric vehicles. Not something like 90% of those batteries are lithium iron, nickel, cobalt, manganese batteries. Okay, there's different types of, so we say, sub-chemistries within those, but they all use nickel, they all use tin, they all use cobalt, manganese, and there's clearly lots of copper in these vehicles as well. There's so much pull from these factories now in terms of material, lithium, graphite, just everything that's required. And frankly, the industry doesn't know where it's all going to come from.
Yeah. Well, we're pre-chatting. We always talk about companies with maybe news out to, or just discussing, you know, companies. So first of all, I saw an RNS yesterday, and I'm always a bit worried when I see RNSs that are quite descriptive or quite sort of bullish, overly so. And I saw one from Iron Ridge Resources, and they said, exceptional scoping study results. And I thought, are they being a bit over the top? A bit, you know, are they talking up this stock a bit? What's the thoughts, John? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, we're always very wary about companies that use terminology like that.
Yeah.
So we discourage it. And in fact, we talk to the qualified executives who are the nomads that police these companies. And we police about 40% of the junior mining sector. So we do a lot of this. In this case, they are justified in the word exceptional, because the scoping study figures on the lithium project in Ghana are very, very good. I mean, the costs are really quite low. Margins are calculated to be very high. Remember, it is a scoping study. This is not quite as much. There's not quite as much detail in here as a pre-feasibility or a bankable feasibility study. But we think they are pretty good numbers. Certainly, there's an NPV here of 334 million. In fact, there are higher NPV estimates if you look at the pre-tax numbers, which is probably more like what the company will eventually be valued at if they build this project. We know that prices are very low for spodumene concentrates at the moment, and in fact they've used a slightly higher price, but I think they're justified in that, because prices for spodumene concentrates were somewhat greater than this a couple of years ago. So we know that there is good interest and strong demand out of the Chinese, because the Chinese do all the processing for lithium out of spodumene these days. We think the Europeans are going to build at least one, or probably two, lithium refineries. You notice that Galp, which is a big Portuguese oil refiner, have bought into Savannah Resources recently. That's very interesting, because we think that Galp will eventually convert or build a new lithium refinery in Portugal, and we think that will help to feed Volkswagen and Mercedes and the other companies that are all converting to produce electric vehicles going forwards. And we know there are various EU rules that say that a certain amount of content has to come from within the European Union. And it may well be, not many people know that Ghana has a specific accord with the EU, which means that it will be able to export lithium or export spodumene into the European Union, I think tariff-free, and in fact with preferential treatment. So from an EU perspective, when it comes to this sort of stuff, I think Ghana is virtually considered to be within the EU. So that will be very helpful for a project like this. I suspect the Chinese will be bidding to get hold of the material. They'll probably be offering to pay the capex as well. We've got the situation with Kodal Minerals, where a very large Chinese company is currently undergoing studies on their Bugimi lithium projects at the moment. So We expect the Chinese, who've already bought into Kodal Minerals to quite a large degree on an equity perspective, I mean, there's a very good chance that they will want to take that project forwards. And we've had an offer from another group who are also quite likely to find some money and shall we say potential other joint venture partners to come in here. So there's a lot happening with these lithium companies right now, and it's a pretty interesting place to be.
Yeah, so I'm quite interested in that, because the use of adjectives in RNS titles, you know, it can be quite biased, of course, kind of, and mislead. But you're saying that it's justified new police, these kind of things, because exceptional, of course, means much greater than usual, especially in skill, intelligence, quality, etc. So this is much greater of quality, is it, than you would get normally? Is that the case? So that these results are, for a scoping study, very good.
We double check these things and we can't tell the company not to use the term exceptional, because actually I think they are justified in using that terminology.
Okay.
We are very careful when many companies want to use the term world class. And you know, if they want to use that term, they have to be able to justify that properly. I mean, yeah. You know, a mining entrepreneur who I won't name, who runs Jubilee Platinum, or used to run Jubilee Platinum, now Jubilee Metals, and recently had a discovery hole with Extract. He's quite prone to using the term world class of just a single drill hole, and we simply won't allow it unless it is a truly world class discovery.
Yeah.
For example, Solgold had a world class discovery in a drill hole at the Alpala project on Cascabel in Ecuador some years ago, and of course they now have BHP and Newcrest as partners, and a very large copper project that hopefully will go into production in the next.
And when you say world class, does that mean what, in the top percentile of discoveries, and what level is that? Is it top 10%, top 5%? What is because it's very, the definitions themselves have to be sort of, don't they, measured in some way, standardized. So what is world class? How do you define that?
There is no hard and fast definition, but it's something that you need to justify within the industry, because if you say that something's world class and it isn't, the industry will shoot you down very, very fast.
And also, and in future, then people are not going to trust you, are they? I mean, you know, if you came out with these overblown hyperboles, you know, the statements, the big shouting statements, and then you don't live up to them, then it's a measure of yourself, isn't it? The management, you can't be trusted, essentially, you know.
But that's absolutely correct. But When you produce a study and you've got a post-tax IRR of 125%, I think that justifies the use of the word exceptional. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, cool. Well, that's good to know. That's Iron Ridge Resources, good stuff. Okay, we were talking pre as well. I mean, a lot of resource stocks are rallying, and we were talking then about strategic minerals. So it's rallying today. They're up 10%, but generally you can put a ruler under their share price, because it's flatlining for a while now. What's your thoughts there, John? Because they're involved in tin, aren't they, and some battery metals and a bit of copper there.
Well, they are, but they've been relatively quiet in terms of, they've been going through that awkward period where they've been working on projects in the background, and those projects haven't had a lot of, shall we say, spectacular news to put to the market. So they get cash in from their Cobra magnetite project in New Mexico in the USA. That should give them about £500,000 worth of free cash in the year. It helps to pay it, that pays for all the corporate costs, and then gives them extra cash to go around and do other drilling and other work. They're developing their Lee Creek copper project in Australia, and they're in that awkward phase where they're just waiting for, well, they're submitting environmental type information to the authorities, and they will then expect to get a permit for that Lee Creek project probably in the second quarter this year. And then we would expect them to start producing copper out of that project towards the end of the year, probably in the fourth quarter, because it'll take a quarter to get things up and running and for the copper to start coming out of the heap leaches. So next year we would expect to see them produce something like 2,500 tons of copper. And then they've got another part of that project that's going to come into production. So we're not quite sure what the production scale is going to be there yet, but hopefully that by 2023 they'll be up to 5,000 tons a year, which will be, again, produce very nice cash flow. And we would expect to see that cash flow being plowed into the Redmore project in Cornwall, which is a tin copper tungsten project. Be nice to see them drilling some more high grade tin there, because tin, of course, is, well, the tin price is at a 7-year high today. It's up at $22,000 a ton. And mining tin at $22,000 a ton is preferable to mining copper at $8,500 a ton, although both metals are extremely popular. So we're hopeful that Redmore will become a decent quality tin, copper, tungsten mine going forwards.
Okay. And they're only, well, of course, 10 million market cap, around about that level. So, you know,
we're currently going through the roadshow, or about to go through the roadshow, for Cornish Metals, which is listing on the London AIM market in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
And there's a great deal of interest in that at the moment because not just because the tin price is high, but because investors are interested in anything that connects them to the growth in the electric vehicle market.
Yeah. Cornish Metals. Okay, keep an eye out for that. When is it listing? Next couple of weeks, is it?
Next few weeks.
Okay, cool. One other thing, just talking about gold. Let's go into gold a sec with Anglo-Asian, AAZ. What's happening there, John?
Well, extraordinary news from them today. They've had a number of licenses restored to them in what's called the disputed territories, which I can never pronounce, Nagorno-Karabakh. I think I got close to it there. So those areas have been disputed for many, many years when Armenia invaded Azerbaijan and then refused to give the land back. And Azerbaijan, quite rightly, didn't want to get involved in too much of a conflict. So recently, the Azeris have pushed the Armenians back, and they've restored these projects to Anglo-Asian Mining. And there's some quite decent-sized projects with very high-grade copper and gold. And that's, well, the fact that those projects are back in the Anglo-Asian portfolio is very good news indeed. And I think that this builds on another discovery that Anglo-Asian made right next to their Gedabek gold mine in Azerbaijan, near the town of Ganja. They discovered a new deposit there, which looks really rather nice. So I think there was a little bit of there must be a certain amount of interest or new interest in the company, and I think this will do very, really well.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous stuff. And they've done very well. One of the outstanding performers of their last few years, Anglo-Asian. So their share price, they've gone from, in fact, they've topped down a little bit recently, haven't they? But they've consolidated for a long time, sold off in the March, in the dash for cash back in March. But they've been a 10 bagger from, 20 pence, less than that. Was it? Look at down there. It was 3 pence there. In 2015, they were 7 pence, the 160. Top dead there. Double top. Wow, look at that double top at in the chart at September 19 and July. They double topped and came back down, but they're consolidating a bit now, aren't they?
Well, this is a company that's worked very hard over many years to overcome all sorts of issues that they've had with metallurgy and the deposit they've been working on. And of course, they had to do that when metals prices were low. There's nothing these guys can't achieve, frankly, because they have a fantastic team in place. I'm not worried about the metallurgy of the new deposit because they've got 4 separate processing lines at Gedabek. They can process anything in almost any form. So without getting into the technicalities of it all, it's a great company, and it knows how to maximize the value of the resources that it has, and the fact that it's now got access to, shall we say, some good quality assets in the disputed territories, I think is great news for them. And it's, you know, they've been very patient and they've not said anything about these deposits for years and years and years. I flew into this region back in, I think, 2005, where the locals were extremely friendly and very keen to see developments happen in the area. And it's good to see the projects back in the fold.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. John, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak you next week.
Thank you, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5. Let me just refresh this. Make sure it's up to date. At 5, Blue Star Capital is down 9% to 0.2. At 4, Ridgecrest up 24.24% at 2.05, or 2.05 today. At 3, Supply Acme Capital. I think they're suspended there. People have followed them, but their accounts aren't on time. So they've changed their accounting date, so they haven't submitted those on time. So a suspend. At 2, Extract Resources, down 1% to... up 5.15. And at 1, Greatland Gold up 1.3% to 28.88. Well, what a mess that I've made. Anyway, this is the most read RNSs are as follows. At 5, Open Orphan, article published in Drug Discovery Today. At 4, Vesarin, interim results. At 3, Greatland Gold, commencement of early works at Haveron. At 2, Erasure Mining, West Kidlam DFS approved. And at 1, Supply Acme Capital, temporary suspension there. That's because their accounts, like I said earlier. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.